Hello, welcome to Time to Say Goodbye. It is the 3rd of April. I'm recording this on the 2nd, and I have a friend on the podcast today, somebody that I've wanted to have on for a while, a thinker that I think that a lot of the listeners here are going to appreciate. He is John Ganz, and he is the author of the Unpopular Front Substack. I imagine that many of you actually subscribe to this or have read it in some capacity. And he is also the author of the upcoming book,
You know what? Some people might think so.
Yeah. But also I'm glad that you laughed at like the semi-racist Asian.
I thought it was just a Freudian slip about the content of the book.
The croc breath.
I didn't realize it. I didn't make the racist accent connection, but there's a lot on there.
You know, what's better is that you didn't say it. You know, I get to say it. And I think, yes, as a guest on the podcast, you get to laugh at it, especially if you just say it wasn't because you sounded Asian. When the clock broke, con men, conspiracists, and how America cracked up in the early 1990s. That is going to be out in June of this year, but you can pre-order it right now. And I don't know, I think it's been getting a lot of good pre-buzz. And what we're going to talk about is sort of this is something that I think that you have spent quite a bit of time on, and that is something that is always present, I think, in the intellectual discourse. In fact, I would say that in terms of the political intellectual discourse, and I'm not talking about just the political discourse, but sort of one step removed, this is the overriding question of the last 7 or 8 years, and it's around the question of fascism and how should we describe this moment in American history?
Right? Yeah.
Do you want to just give us a sort of rundown of the origins of this debate? You know, you don't have to go so deep into it, but and then how it sort of metastasized into this constant kind of thrum online. Yep.
I don't exactly know. I know when I started arguing with people, and I remember that some of the early pieces about it, but I think very early on there were pieces when Trump emerged saying that he was a fascist. And shortly thereafter, there were pieces responding to this. I mean, from my perspective, the reason why I start, and this is before I really wrote very much or had any kind of platform whatsoever, but that was one of my first feelings about it, was that there was something at least a little bit fascist about it, both because of his rhetoric, the kinds of people that were drawn to it. And like, you know, what I noticed was Trump was very exciting for people on the extreme right, who always felt kind of alienated from the Republican Party and thought that they were cucks, and a term that became very popular at the time, or just, you know, were betraying their cause. And Trump like made them very happy for the first time in a long time. So I was like, okay, there's something strange going on here. Then I thought, you know, this would be self-evident to everybody. And I was like, yeah, of course it's a little bit fascist. I mean, we don't have to freak out and think he's the second coming of Hitler to see some comparisons. And then I started arguing with a lot of people about this, and this became kind of a vocation. it's not the only thing I do with my writing, but it's a constant thing. And yeah, basically, you know, there's this split into two groups essentially of people who believe that there is something fascist about Trump, and that using the history of European fascism tells us something interesting about him, and those who basically believe it doesn't. And they have, I have my own reasons why I think that they say no. They have their own reasons why they think they say no. But part of it is like a lot of the people on the left, let's say, there are people, let's just discount the people on the right for a moment. The people on the left who say he's not a fascist, there's a political strategy behind that. They think that strengthens kind of the centrist liberals and marginalizes the left and makes it so you have to form a kind of popular front and vote with the liberals and not actually, you know, and the hegemony of liberals is a bigger problem than the right wing, which is actually quite weak. These are all related thoughts that a lot of these people have. I just don't think that that is like, yeah, I mean, obviously questions of practice and strategy are, I just don't think that's that germane to the discussion. I think you have to just like tell the truth about something and then you think about what you do about it. I just think that that's like weird prescribing the party line according to what political effects it has.
Right.
Is just not the way I think. Like, I'm like, no, if it's true, it's true. So that's the way I've always approached it. I was like, it just seems that way to me, and I have reasons why. But so I've been frustrated with him for a lot of reasons. I don't want to like go, I don't know, how far do you want me to go into my like theories of why they actually think this, or should we go more into?
Let's go a little bit more into why you think, right?
Okay.
Like what, yeah, what the characteristics are. Because I think that in terms of the question of political strategy and what it means, like, I think we can talk about it a little bit later, because I want to get into sort of the, you are at least a few times on social media, you've been a defender of kind of the normie liberal, right? The normie resistance liberal. And that's an idea that honestly, I think about probably more than I should, just because in part and parcel, and I think the listeners know this because of where I live, where I'm basically surrounded by the purest distillation of the resistance
liberals,
the resistance liberal ever, and it's sort of broken my brain in some way. But let's get to that in a little bit. So right now, just tell me a little bit about like why you, like the arguments that you have laid out over the past few years.
All right. So the first argument is just based on the way he sounds and his rhetoric, and you know, he talks about the United States in serious decline, and being kind of betrayed by its elites, infected by unclean ethnic minorities, and his movement is this kind of historically very special thing that's unprecedented, that's going to return America to previous greatness. I mean, that just looks like fascism according to one definition, which is that it's a form of ultra nationalism that tries to affect a national rebirth. I mean, so there's that. Then there's also more structural and political things, like Trump represented a protest vote attacking the Republican Party from outside, right? And he attacked the party from inside and basically took it over. And to me, this looked very much like the way it had some analogy to the way fascist movements worked in Europe, which was that they were sort of a outside of the establishment of conservatives, could provide a kind of popular punch and the strength and dynamism of a movement that these elites had lost and didn't really have, because they didn't really have much of a constituency. They didn't have a mass constituency. So Trump brought a mass constituency to a declining conservative elite that really couldn't sell people anymore on wars abroad or cutting Medicare and stuff like that. So I think that that's his attack on the Republican Party from outside. And then the process by which the elites kind of formed an alliance or a coalition with him that's been uneasy and obviously fraught, but they've never been able to totally jettison him. Then, people were saying, well, he was so weak as a president, he couldn't really get that done. For me, that doesn't really hold much water. I was like, I don't, you know, fascist doesn't mean invincible. It's just a type of politics, right? It doesn't mean they're necessarily going to win. There's lots of failed fascist movements in Europe that just fizzled and went nowhere, and Hitler and Mussolini could have both failed. Or been much less powerful, and but I think what really did it for me, and I was shocked. I mean, my whole attitude this entire time has been kind of shocked that people don't see things the way I do. But I try to articulate it. Is that, you know, once January 6th happened, basically look, I will admit that some people on my side of the debate have rather melodramatic, vulgar, hair on fire ways of talking about this. Trump is going to be Hitler. He's going to put us in camps. He's going to do this. He's going to do that. But, you know, one prediction was, well, he's going to do something like a fascist movement would do, which is to mobilize a mob and try to do some kind of putsch to stay in power when constitutionally he really ought not to be, or his powers are limited. Well, that happened. It may have not happened in a serious, serious way. He may have not actually had the structures in place to make that happen, but that was a real thing that happened. So then I was like, okay, well, this is holding a lot more water than I believe, you know, its critics admit. And then after that, I was very frustrated because I was like, all right, look, I actually had. So Robert Paxton is a very famous scholar of fascism and who I happen to know a little bit. And he was a skeptic the whole time. And I had a ton of respect for him. And I read what he wrote. And I was like, okay, you know, his skepticism makes sense. After January 6th happened, he said, look, man, this is really a red line. I can't say no anymore. And he wrote about it. And he said, I've changed my mind. And I thought, okay, some of these people are now going to say, like, yeah, it's probably not a very successful or powerful fascism. It's really, you know, has to work with the Republican Party structures and can't take them over entirely. But there's at least something a little bit fascist about it. I mean, Trump was saying things that Mussolini would have said, like, we're the greatest movement in history. You're participating in history by being with me. You know, this kind of rhetoric has a long history. And I think intentionally so. I think a lot of the people who work for him are nuts and are looking at this stuff. But like, so anyway, I just thought that was a real clear turning point of the whole thing. And now they're turning, you know, the martyrs, the people who died or were in jail into martyrs. And I just was like, this is clearer and clearer to me. A lot of people don't see it that way. I get increasingly frustrated with that and have my own reasons of why they're doing it. The other thing is like Trump's entire, from my perspective, Trump's entire politics from the beginning is basically like an assault on the citizenship of certain types of Americans, right? Where does it begin? Trump, even before the attack on the Republican Party part, he comes from the Tea Party movement, essentially. And he starts with the birther stuff, which, you know, we think is kind of quaint now. But what is the real subtext of that? It's saying that, you know, Obama is not a citizen. And the entirety of the Trump's movement from then to the election denial shit is the election denial shit is a myth. Like, it's not, everyone said, oh, this is a lie. They don't actually believe it. It's a myth. I mean, they believe it in a way. They don't believe it reflects some factual thing. It's a insight into their worldview, which is that certain people, certain types of people, blacks, people living in cities, liberals, gays, whatever, and it's different for different members of the coalition who they think about this way, are not really American citizens, are not citizens. And that's, you know, a through line through the whole thing, from the birther stuff to the election stuff. And you see that also really powerfully in Trump's weird moves, which don't get talked about very much, but I think are quite disturbing, of like talking about ending birthright citizenship, right? You know, and by fiat. Like, that's really crazy stuff. So I find that to be quite fascist, the attack on the citizenship rights of certain people that are either ideological political enemies or racial enemies. I just think that that's kind of the right word for it. So that's basically my point of view, I suppose.
From like a political valence standpoint, right? Like, what do you think is like the benefit of labeling whatever? Like, I think that people on the left, right, your critics on the left would agree that this stuff is bad. I think that almost all of them would say this is bad, but they would just say, I don't want to use that word for whatever reason. For you, like, yeah. What's the importance of actually using that word?
I'm not quite sure, actually. I don't know if there's actually part of this is just out of, I mean, I accuse my opponents of being stubborn and frustrated. Part of this is just about winning at this point, because I think I'm right. I don't know that I would think. I think Biden was okay to say it was semi-fascist. I think he's exactly right when he said that. I think it also gives people a fear. I mean, it's hard because I do think like there's a tendency to overreact but I do think it gives people a clear idea of what we're facing, and there's practical consequences that come of it. But from my perspective, I'm a journalist, I'm a writer. What grounds what I do, I'm not a propagandist, I hope not, is just trying to tell the truth. So I'm like, that's sort of my first commitment. I think that, like, you know, political strategy can change for different reasons, and I'm not a strategist and I'm not a politician, and, you know, I don't know what the practical upshot of what I say all the time, but like, basically I view my function as like, you know, I have to tell the truth so far as I can see it. So it's kind of more that. But there is a point at which, like, look, I am arguing because these people are still arguing the opposite, and I'm mad, you know, like
there is
some peak personal peak involved.
I don't know. It's interesting because I go back and forth on this, and I've honestly, as I've followed the debate, I think I've gone in and out of agreement and disagreement. But I think that in the end, I do see some political valence in using the term if it's appropriate, right? Like where. Right. I mean, I don't think that I don't want to get too resistance liberal about this right. stuff. And I also think, like, as a journalist, you know, I shouldn't indulge in too much of this stuff in my work. But, you know, just as a personal person who happens to not be white and who would not have citizenship in the United States if Donald Trump had his way, I don't think or at least a lot of his supporters wouldn't. Right. That I think that. You know, it is galvanizing. And I guess I think that, like, it's things have to be put in proper perspective. So, yeah, like, you know, I remember when Charlottesville happened, for example, right?
Yeah.
I was working at Vice and we put together like this big, big viral, super viral news short documentary, basically, where Ellie Reeve was talking to some of these guys. And I remember that, and it really gave a sense of terror, I think, to everyone who watched it. And I think ton of people watched that thing, right?
Yeah.
And Ellie had been reporting on these people for a while. And I remember at first I was like, I don't know, some of these dudes seem like they're just kind of pathetic losers. Maybe we shouldn't give them the space. And then for a while, I also thought somewhat similarly about the thing that we had made. I thought it was like gorgeous and well done and everything like that. But then I was like, well, I don't know. These are dudes with tiki torches. Like, do we really want to scare people into giving them more power than they deserve? Right. So that was one thought I had.
Sure.
But then like, and so I was like, we have to keep that in perspective. But I think that there's this thing that happens where some of your critics also don't quite they minimize that, but they also minimize the way in which the public responds to some of this stuff. Right.
Yeah.
Like when after the election, after the inauguration, when Trump put in the Muslim ban, like there are real protests everywhere around the country, right? There's a real mobilization at that point, and it was the fear of fascism, right? That they felt like this was the first step and that there was a real resistance to that.
Yeah.
And I think that what people think in a lot of ways is that, you know, all of it doesn't matter. Right. Like the resistance didn't matter. The Muslim ban didn't matter.
Right.
Actually, Trump was just trying stuff out. And when, like, you know, you had like Steve Bannon, Stephen Miller basically explicitly saying extremely troubling things and trying to put them in action through executive orders.
Yep.
And that the resistance might have had something to do with the fact that they were ineffectual. Right. And so that, you know, from a political valence standpoint, there is a question of like, I don't know if this stuff works to change the bad outcomes that you want, then perhaps it's worth taking more seriously than you guys seem to be taking it. Your critics.
Well, there's a strange nihilism about everything that happens that they just kind of reserve the right to not take things seriously and then only kind of take things seriously in the context of doing a gotcha, like being like, oh, well, you didn't think it was important when this happened. I was like, well, maybe I did. I don't know. Like, why are you doing this? Like it seemed to be always about owning the libs in a weird left wing way, you know, like being like, oh, well, you're selectively hysterical about this kind of stuff. And I'm like, no, I'm reading what these people actually think. I mean, Steve Bannon, kind of a fucking idiot and ineffectual, but like if you're familiar at all with this stuff and then you hear what he's talking about reading, you're like, this guy is a fucking Nazi. Like, you know, like,
and Miller too, right?
Like, yeah, exactly. Miller. You read their, like, they're like, my favorite book is like Julius Evola. And I'm like, that's not good. And then, you know, you bring up these facts to people and they either just they minimize them. Or they're like, oh, well, he's such a fuck. And I'm like, yeah, they're all fucks. Like, that's, I think, also a misconception that I think people have about historical fascism is like, we have these images that come from fascist propaganda of like these highly motivated, organized groups and blah, blah, blah. And like, yeah, there's something to that, but a lot of that is propaganda. Like these movements in real time didn't look invincible. they looked like a part of the political equation that could gain power and had various ways of doing it. And there were many contingent points upon the along the way in which they could have failed and did not. Like, we have a very cartoonish understanding of what fascism is, and that is one that, weirdly enough, the people who want to deflate the whole fascism argument rely upon. Their whole thing is parasitic on this really cartoonish picture of fascism, because everyone knows what the stormtroopers look like. Everybody knows the Nuremberg rallies and the black shirts. And if it doesn't exactly fit that image, then it can't be. And then you can't come up with an argument. You're like, oh, of course it's ridiculous, because it's not as scary and not as you know, the pageantry is not as intense. And granted, and that's why I'm willing to say, look, it's not exactly the same. I think it's not, it's like some sort of fascioid, para-fascist, proto-fascist thing. But what my entire point is this, I think, going back to what you think the practical upshot is like, obviously this history is relevant. Like, they want to say that's an irrelevant context. I'm not saying it's exactly the same or history is going to repeat itself. I'm like, look, when you're trying to understand something new, you have a bunch of different contexts you can try to put it in. And obviously that's a fucking context that we should put it in. Because look who got excited about Trump is all these Nazis. Like, you're talking about Charlottesville. They were like, oh, yay, our time is here. Our guy is now. They were like, they felt, maybe wrongly or mistakenly, they felt, and I feel like they understand their political tradition pretty well. They're like, it's not only Trump's racism. It's not only Trump's, you know, all that rhetoric. It's also like their politics intrinsically require a strong man. Like, that's what, there's a political theory behind it, of a leader, a providential leader, a Führer, a Duce. Like, and that's what excited them as much as the racist content. That's why Ron DeSantis doesn't, I mean, maybe for some of the dorkier policy oriented ones, like, he can be as racist as he wants, but he's not the boss, right? They need this boss figure. And the sheer charisma of Trump, the kind of messianic hysteria that he's driven some people to me, I'm like, okay, yet again, that seems a little fascist to me. The mass rally, so on and so forth. But the thing is like, he's very American and participates in a lot of Americana that are actually reassuring. Like, he's like, as I said, you know, Ross Perot was like a right-wing, or kind of arguably right-wing populist, and he kind of built into a kind of cowboy archetype, you could say. And Trump does the same thing, but he's a gangster archetype. And I think that actually, weirdly enough, that makes people feel comfortable with him, because they're like, he's a wise guy. He's got a New York voice. Like, you know, like, there's something reassuringly familiar about Trump, where I don't think he scares people maybe as much as he ought to. In the same way, like, a gangster kind of like puts his arm around your shoulder and kind of leers and winks at you and makes you feel okay. I think that Trump is actually kind of good at calming. Weirdly enough, for someone who upsets people so much, in a weird way, he's like good at being like, relax.
He's good at basically deflecting his own scariness. He needs to be exactly one-to-one, and that basically the only fascist movement that could exist in America is one that looked exactly like what you say are propagandistic images of fascism, which I tend to agree with you about. It's just like, if you really think that fascist movement grew without the help of, like, you know, shitheads, right? That everything like was people marching in a perfect line, and that's what it needs to look like. Like, that's crazy. You know, like, that's, there are many things that happened within the rise of fascism and Germany and Italy that probably did look a lot like Charlottesville, and maybe we're even at the same scale as Charlottesville. But the question I guess, is like, you know, like, do you think that it's deflated at this point? Like, do you, because this debate is still raging, right? And my thought is just like, well, we just had 4 years of Joe Biden, right? And so do you think it's less at the forefront or less important, or what do you think here?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I tend to think like Trump is less scary to, it's weird. Like, more people have like come around to what I'm saying, and they're like, Trump's really saying things that scare me now. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, he seems like more toothless now than ever to me. Like, in 2016, when he was running for president, I was like, oh, fuck, this is not good. And now I'm like, yeah, man, like he may be losing a step just because he's so old. And I think also, like, honestly, the far right did not kind of mushroomed during, you know, Trump's first term, but haven't converted it into that much political organization. Like, he's the sort of the only thing they got. Like, Charlottesville ended up being, I think, a pretty big setback for them in the end. I think that January 6th, you know, obviously they're trying to do this whole martyrdom stuff, but like, they're all super paranoid now because the FBI has infiltrated them and they don't want to organize, and they like don't trust each other. And they're like, I do believe that organizationally they are kind of weak. But that being said, like, you know, these militias that are out there that, you know, you see which were big during the pandemic, actually, and around the time the George Floyd protests. I mean, dude, you know, we say, oh, there aren't really organized far right paramilitaries. They were showing up at state capitals with fucking rifles during the pandemic and the George Floyd protests. I mean, that was pretty fucking scary stuff. And I think a lot of those groups have been sort of falling apart through infighting and FBI infiltration shit. But like those, I think what's important is like those groups to realize, like, genealogically and structurally, those groups are just the Ku Klux Klan without the hoods. Like, that's what you have to look when you see those militias. You can't buy the, oh, we're just, you know, concerned citizens bullshit. Like, you really have to be like, that's the Klan. Like, that's basically what that is.
But it's that group of people who like march with khakis and blue shirts.
Yeah, like the 3%ers or whatever.
Oh, no,
yeah.
No, these are people in Idaho.
Oh, those guys are even more.
Yeah, yeah,
more hardcore. Right, yeah, right. The fucking Patriot Front. And yeah, they're not. Again, like, I understand the inclination of people to poo poo this stuff because they're not drawing huge crowds. Right. But things are different in the age of the internet. Political activism works differently. I mean, like, masses of people appear and are rallied online, and, you know, you don't have to leave your house to do political activism, and you don't have to risk, you know, public exposure, which is a big fear for a lot of these people. I do believe, but, you know, if you look at Trump's like plans for the kinds of crazy things they're going to try to do if he gets reelected again, I mean, he's going to, like, here's what it comes down to, dudes. Does anybody in their right mind, like, putting aside the question of whether he can actually do it, does anybody think that he really doesn't want to be dictator? And if he could push a button and he was just in charge of everybody, he could make it people shut up he didn't like, or even throw them in jail or kill them, he right. wouldn't do it? Of course he would. And of course he would. And that's been clear. The second thing is, do you really think if you were a Nazi and you, let's say you're a fascist and you had sat down with Trump and you explained your whole program to him and you said, well, you're going to be the big boss in charge of everything. And at your disposal, you're going to have a bunch of guys who listen to you and go and beat up and kill the people you don't like. And we're going to make the country great again. And you're going to be the greatest leader we ever had. He would probably be like, yeah, that sounds about right. Like, that's basically you could sell him on all this shit very easily. That, I mean, like, he'll listen to almost anything or anything, but I just think that his instincts about politics are fundamentally fascist. He's like, you got to beat the shit out of the, you got to beat the shit out of the fucking loser, I can't say this word, the F words who you know oppose us, and scare them, and we'll get our shit done and make the country the way it's supposed to be with the types of people who are supposed to be in charge. And yeah, I think the racism obviously is more complicated now because, like, he's weird. But I think that's another reason to call it fascism, is because everyone's like, oh, well, white supremacy has a long history in America. Sure. But obviously there's a place in Trumpism for people of color, to use that kind of old term now. So it's more fascist than white supremacist. Because, I mean, obviously white people are meant to be on top in the order, but there's places for people who aren't white to kind of like be like, no, I also hate those fucking people, this group of people or that group of people, and I really closely identify with this guy. I think it's obviously a mistake to join that coalition and it'll bite them in the ass. But that's why fascism was also really ideologically malleable. Like, there were some fascists who were really big anti-Semites, obviously. There were some fascists who are not anti-Semites. So I think the malleability of Trumpism also kind of lends itself to the label.
Right. Well, yeah. Where do you think, I mean, getting back a little bit to this debate, and then we can talk more broadly, right?
Yeah.
You know, people like Samuel Moyne, Corey Robin, yeah. Like these are real, these are people who are very respected, I would say, with on, especially amongst the left in terms of left intellectuals.
Yeah.
And that, like, they seem, I have, I think I read Corey's book about Clarence Thomas. I thought it was a very good book. And I've talked to him a little bit online, and he's somebody I respect. And Sam Moyne, you know, same thing, work I respect. I am puzzled, I will say, but, and maybe I should just ask them this, but I'm puzzled by their investment in this, in this debate, right?
Yeah.
And why it's gotten so acrimonious. And for the listeners who don't know, I mean, this, John wrote a piece this morning in response to a piece that Andrew Marantz, who is a colleague of mine at The New Yorker, wrote. And Andrew, I think Andrew's piece, I think we talked about it. I don't think Andrew would object to this characterization at all.
Yeah.
Andrew kind of gave like a, this is what it's like. And I think Andrew did a very good job of pulling himself away from taking a side in any of this, right? Like he's...
Well, yeah.
To the extent that one can, right? Like, yeah. Where it was like not, I actually learned more about the debate than I learned about what Andrew thought about it, right? And that's a particular skill. If I had written it, then you would just hear what I thought
right,
about
right,
it.
Right, 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 right.
That's, that would be,
yeah, well, me too. I'm yeah. I'm totally partisan in this.
Right, right. I would have been partisan as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, that piece has sort of re-kicked up this debate. Like, what is the reasoning behind, like, the pitch of this debate, right? Like, why is it so
angry?
Intense? Yeah, why is everyone why are these dudes so angry? Like, for me, like, well, I actually don't even understand it myself. And I know I talk to you a lot. Yeah.
Oh, I know why I'm angry. Well, I mean, I have a foul temperament maybe to begin with, but I think that I don't like the fucking I don't like their fucking attitude. No, like I basically believe that there's a lot of what people like to call gatekeeping going on right here, that a lot of these is sort of academics protecting their turf. And there's a lot of, like, beyond that, that's one sociological interpretation. Another interpretation is that there is a certain sense of vulgarity in labeling things fascist. And I believe that these people are highly on what I'm saying right now are ad hominem and highly uncharitable interpretations. Okay. So let's just put that up front. They're kind of defending their turf, and they're kind of also playing a status game in which they denigrate the labeling things of fascist, because that's something that, like, real serious academics and intellectuals don't do. Right. It's beneath them. So that's one reason why I think that the reason why some of them are getting, I don't know. A lot of them seem to kind of keep their cool. Like, even though they're, I think, act like dicks in other ways. But I think the reason why it's so intensely fought out is because both sides think very little of each other, because they think the other side are basically intellectually bankrupt. That one side thinks one side are either totally suckered by liberal ideology or are hucksters trying to scare people. And the other side says what I just said and thinks, like, we just don't have very much respect for each other anymore. And how it got that way, I'm not quite so sure. I think it's just, like, people intensely believe that they're right. And they're very frustrated with each other's lack of openness or charity about each other's views. For me, you know, I'm absolutely a little unhinged when it comes to this sometimes. And I'm the first to admit it. And I'm, you know, I feel passionately about it, and sometimes that gets excessive. But I also engage with the arguments of everybody who's basically written about this. And this might make me sound a little crackpot, but they've never really engaged back. You know, they've been dismissive. They've said, but no one has actually argued with me point by point, argument by argument, interpretation by interpretation. And that makes me mad, because I feel, and this might, again, you know, I'm self-aware about sounding a little crazy in this, is and why I bring up the whole gatekeeping thing is that I feel like they're systematically trying to stack the deck against people who are actually taking what they're doing seriously and just disagreeing strongly and making the case against them. And they're trying to make their opponents look silly and bad. And they don't, they're not being charitable. They're not being open. They're using a lot of mockery. So I use it back. A lot of these people I had more respect for at the beginning of this debate. And in fact, there are people whose work I read and inspired me to start my projects. And I've used with great profit and, you know, people I admired now, or even I was somewhat friendly with. And now that's not the case. I think that they're a bunch of assholes. And I don't know how it, you know, how does anything start? How does anything get ugly? I'm sure I played a big part in it with the amount of sarcasm I use or the amount of heat that I bring to a fight. But I honestly believe that sometimes these people have not been intellectually honest. They've been fast and loose with the facts. They haven't engaged with their opponents in good faith. They've constantly resorted to kind of ad hominem, you know, making their opponents sound like they're crazy or stupid.
All right. Yeah, Samoin called you like a sub-stacker today, which,
well,
I made the point quite uncharitable on his part.
I said these guys are really smug and condescending, and he goes, "Hell hath no fury like a sub-stacker scorn."
Yeah, that, I mean, he deleted it. Maybe he regrets it, but that was,
I bet,
like,
he fucking did, because makes my point exactly what
right.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, you exactly, you schmuck. That's you are exactly my point. And also, it's like not even that witty. Like, that's the other thing. There's a certain kind of like unearned pompousness where these people think they're like great dons of academia, and I'm like, dude, you're not. You're just a fucking schmuck like everybody else and trying your best to make an argument. And I think that, like, that haughtiness really, really provokes me, and I have no problem.
Like, you don't have to convince me about the academic gatekeeping people who are outside, who are getting yelled at by the, like, sort of the academic establishment. But yeah. Let me add something to this, because, yes, like, outside of the sort of interpersonal part of it, which I find interesting, I do think that there are stakes for the outsiders, even if this is just you and them just kind of going back and having like a fight. The stakes for me are just like, well, what do we do about, is there an intellectual defense of the resistance liberal, right? Like, of the person who tweets all day about how America is fascist, how Trump is a fascist, how we're descending into Nazi Germany. And for me, like, I guess, like, I think about it two ways. The first is that there's an aesthetic distaste, I think, that is behind a lot of this, right? That that the people who say those types of things are thought of as lame. Somebody like Brooklyn Resistance Dad or whatever, right? Like, I mean, that's a very extreme example. But even like people who put up signs like "Refugees are welcome here" and their very nice lawns in Short Hill, New Jersey, or whatever. Like, these are people who are aesthetically, for the people on the left outside, beyond the pale, right?
Yeah.
And that,
which is so funny, because Republicans think those are the left, right?
right. No,
they're not aware of, like, Democratic Socialists for America, like, dirtbag podcasters are like, "We're the real left." They're like, they don't know you exist.
Yeah, they don't know you exist. They legitimately think it's like Brooklyn, like, Defiance Day.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they're like they might confuse left. You guys for the right. They're like, "Oh, that's one of us." And they're like, "Wait, what is socialism?" But that's that's what, to me at least, is sort of being discussed here, which is, and that's how, why I found it interesting, because I feel like there's this melding here where the aesthetics of the question, or the question almost gets posed aesthetically by a lot of people that actually really kind of bothers me, because it does seem like a lot of things are at stake. I mean, a second Trump presidency would be really bad, right? And I don't think that these people would deny that in any sort of way.
No.
And that from a, it almost becomes like, yes, we as a left need a way to distinguish ourselves from that, right? Because that we should not be held hostage by vote blue no matter who, and people right. just screaming in our faces that it's our fault that Hillary Clinton wasn't the president of the United States. Yeah. And all that is intensified right now, I would say, by the fact, you know, by the war going on and people basically being like, well, what was the difference if Joe Biden is going to do this, right? And so there's this pitch to it, I think, that the left really wants to distinguish itself on moral grounds at one level, which I support and I understand. But then there's also like, that's not really the origins of this, right? Because of this, these origins started way before October 7th. The origins of it, to me, almost feel, they really do kind of feel aesthetic, right? It's just like, I am not one of them, right? Like, I am not one of the resistance
demarcation.
Liberals. Right, well, and I'm something more serious. And that the defense seems to be like a defense of what is serious.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And that's related. The academics are doing it for the intellectual side, and the less intellectuals are doing it a different way. But it's a matter of like social demarcation of like, you know, we're somehow better, we're somehow smarter, we're somehow more serious. And that's one sociological interpretation I think is right. The question is whether or not that actually has some political stakes. And I think some people on the left have a strategic view, which says, well, we need to divide, we need to define ourselves, we need to differentiate ourselves as a movement, as a group from liberal culture, and have a counter-hegemonic narrative that changes things. Otherwise, we're just swallowed up in it. We cannot be a junior member of this coalition forever. Like, we have to create our own identity. I don't think this is the right way to, I understand what they're saying. I don't think this is like the right way to create our own identity. I have the opposite view, which is just like almost Leninist view, which is that you have to, the right winger is going to really have fun with that. The left wing basically has to constantly put itself on the forefront of every issue that is progressive, more or less. So if there is a fight against fascism, you can't leave it to the liberals, right? You have to be like, no, we have the best interpretation of that. And I think actually the left got a lot out of that by being like, Trump scared of that. Well, guess why that happened? Because we let like things get really bad in this country, and you know, let conditions get so terrible that, you know, and blah blah blah. It just made me, I grew up as a leftist, but when Trump came along, I didn't move to my right and be like, I gotta be a. At first, I did, because I was like, oh well, we gotta get behind Hillary because this is bad stuff. So I did move a little to my right that time. But then when he won, I was like, oh shit, now I gotta move way to the left because obviously the fucking liberals are useless. I mean, they turned out to be less useless but I thought like, okay, now like an actual left winger has to stand up. And in some ways, you know, like, the left is more a part of the Democratic coalition than it was before. Bernie has a big committee chair. I mean, this is all starting to fall apart and get bad, very bad with October 7th in Gaza. But there was a time in which, you know, the Democratic Party, both in its rhetoric and its policy, seemed to move pretty left. And I was like, okay, they're making the right moves. They're getting more social democratic. They're dropping the fucking neoliberal shit, you know, which I thought was a long-term need. I guess it's a matter, I think some people, like, I think Bhaskar Sankara, the guy who writes, who's the editor, is he still the editor of Jacobin? Oh no, him and another guy who made a similar argument to me, basically like, it's the wrong political strategy for the left to follow Popular Front. Calling it fascism makes the need for a Popular Front, which is like, you got to ally with the liberals. And it's the wrong time for that. The left needs to create its own identity. It can't just be, I don't know. Again,
well, what do you think about that idea? Cause I think that's the, like, in terms of, let's say that there's a credible argument against this, right? In terms of outside of the historical
corollaries, right? It's one that I think about quite a bit, and I try and separate it from my own frustrations. I found the 2016-2020 elections as a somebody who, you know, supported Bernie Sanders to be quite frustrating, especially 2020.
Oh, sure.
And that I found that the sort of dismissal of any concerns that people might have, right, out to a "it's your fault if we lose" to be like to be kind of insulting on a personal level, but also yeah. I feel like it was probably going to push away a lot of young people from the Democrat Party overall. I don't think that has happened necessarily yet, but we don't know, right? Because there could be shifts coming up, but like I don't think that people are ever going to vote for Donald Trump, right? Like,
no, probably not.
We both have the benefit and the hindrance of not really knowing what's happening because we have such a polarizing candidate and such a polarizing set of choices. But maybe, you know, if there's less polarizing choices, that we might see some movement in either way. But, you know, like that seems to be the core of the question, which is like, should we join the popular front or not? Should there be one or should there not be one? Outside yeah. of the question of fascism here, like, I mean, what do you think about that? Like, if that's what, I don't know if Bhaskar said that or not. It sounds like something he would say, but let's just
yeah.
describe it to somebody said this, right? Like, what would you say to somebody?
Well, I mean, look, it's very hard now. There was a time where I would have said absolutely, but I don't know. I don't think it's worthwhile to yell at people how to vote anymore. I've given up on that. But like, and I think they like it, so you can't do it. If they disagree with you, they want to have that fight. I think that honestly, Gaza makes this whole question a lot harder because, you know, the whole idea that the liberals were on the progressive side of history, that we were standing up to authoritarianism everywhere, you know, Ukraine and so on and so forth. And, you know, it was democracy against authoritarianism. The situation in Gaza just throws a huge wrench into that whole story. That's really difficult to completely square. I mean, the government in Israel is, you know, in effect in its practices, fairly fascist, and it has literal fascists in coalition with it. I mean, it has people who are Kahanists and, you know, the real far right of Israel, and the United States support, the West support for that, makes it very difficult to say, you know, the Western liberalism is the progressive force in the world compared to all these other things going on. And, you know, as a principled anti-fascist, you have to stick with the West and liberal democracy. It's making a mockery of all that, unfortunately. I mean, Israel is the big problem for anti-fascism as a politics, because as an anti-fascist, what do you do with Israel, right? Well, on the one hand, it was created in response to the Holocaust. On the other hand, it's an apartheid state that is becoming increasingly frighteningly run by the worst people in the world. And I think a lot of people are saying is currently committing genocide, and with some good reason. I mean, the United Nations says, yeah, it might be. And, you know, that's not just rhetoric anymore. Like, these are things that actually have to be thought about. So I understand, especially, look, I think when it comes to a lot of these things, it's like, I don't begrudge people their anger in the situation and frustration with Biden. I do believe from historical evidence and who he surrounds him with and what he says, I don't think that Trump is going to be any better for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict than Biden. And I think he would basically Biden says they do all these stupid things like, oh, we need to do humanitarian aid, and which are arguably hypocritical and ineffective. But I think that Trump, the risk is that he would just drop the hypocrisy altogether and just said, kill him. You know,
well,
you know?
Like, yeah, yeah. You see hints of it with like Jared Kushner basically saying, hey, we should convert convert all of Gaza to like seaside estates for, you know, like, I mean, you see stuff like that, but
yeah, exactly.
I mean, I don't want to give too much time to this, but I think we should say there is like this real, some people call, I don't know what the right word is, but it's like the fantasy of imaginary Trump.
Yeah.
What imaginary Trump would do. And that I think it's a really dangerous way of thinking for people on the left, where they say that Trump would be better than Biden on this, which I think that you can criticize Biden rightfully as much as you want and as much as you should.
But like, come on, like you can't, like, do you really think that Donald Trump would be motivated by anything other than like making, I don't know, like $600,000 extra dollars or something like that? He would do anything, right?
Well, and he's so, also surrounded by people of extreme Zionist convictions, you know,
and
not by like long-term State Department people who are like, we need to balance the interests of the United States.
Right.
friendly. He's balanced by, he's surrounded by like settler nut job type people. Like the thing is, I think, you know, not to, to belabor the point too much, but it, this does connect it to the fascism thing, is that, you know, for certain people on the anti-imperialist left, there has always been a fascist temptation because they looked like alternate powers that were challenging the hegemony of the capitalist imperialist powers, right? So Italy, like Mussolini had this notion of Italy and Germany as proletarian nations, right? Compared to America, England, France, these big capitalist empires. So I think there's a fascist temptation among anti-imperialists sometimes, which is that the fascist alternative would somehow be preferable to the liberal imperialist hegemony. Historically, not true. They're worse. But, you know, I do think that that is part of like the politics of some people on the extreme left who like Vladimir Putin more than Joe Biden for, you know, I think that's that there is a, especially when there's no left wing, you know, like, well, who embodies your ideals? This is this guy who kind of like pays lip service occasionally to anti-colonial ideals, but is a racist dictator. Like,
right.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah, or create, like lip service to a broad idea of populism that you think captures your ideals, but actually doesn't, you know, in any type of way that actually what it is meant to do is drive out immigrants and gay people and basically everybody who, you know, like that's the populism. It's not an economic populism.
No, not really.
But it's only really framed as such. Yeah, I think about, you know, like I guess I like think about in terms of J.D. Vance or somebody like that, where if you just excerpted some of what he said, that it might be acceptable for somebody on the left, but then you actually see his actions and what he votes for and how he aligns himself, and like there's basically no deviation from Trump at all, right?
Well, he went from being like Trump critic to being like, this is really bad, and then just be like, well, to win at my party today, I have to be like a weird racist.
Right. Okay, so the last question I have for you, and like, you know, that we can get, and it's just a corollary to what I asked before, because I think we should, you know, we sort of skimmed around it, which is, I agree that the concept of the popular front and the we must defeat Trump type of thing has been complicated by what's happening in Gaza, and that I do not begrudge anybody for saying that I'm just not going to do it. You know, like we had this huge debate about what's happening in Michigan, for example, right, with the Arab populations there. And that I actually have seen much less of this than I thought. And I think that it's actually a testament to people's like sense of outrage about this, where I really felt like there is going to be a lot of scolding, right? Like, how could they not see that Trump is going to be worse and they're so stupid if they're withholding their vote or whatever, right? And I think what we've seen is like, A, we've seen not that much withholding of votes, right? Like, And B, what we've seen is that people are actually somewhat more understanding of that than they would be.
Yeah.
And that's partially because the U.S. support of the war is becoming increasingly and increasingly more unpopular, especially amongst Democrats who, you know, for a Democratic primary and people who are Democratic voters or who are relevant, right? But I don't know. Like, the argument I think that your critics would say is that you are advocating for this popular front regardless, that that you think it's a good thing and that normie liberals are right about this one thing. Is that, do you think that's a correct characterization of what you're saying?
They can vote the way they want to. I don't care. I mean, I know what I would do, and I think you can enjoy my writing and have with a lot of different political views. I don't know. I do think that like I will say this. I think normie liberals' sense of the political terrain in terms of what's possible is a lot smarter than a lot of people said it was. Like, they were made fun of as being sort of dowdy and out of touch and had no idea what was going on in the country, and then kind of like fueled two pretty surprising electoral victories that were pretty robust, and then they don't look as stupid as they should. You know, like they've mobilized. They're like, everyone's like, these people are out of touch. They don't know anything. I mean, they're politically potent. So I would just say, don't ignore or mock. You mock the normie liberal at your peril, I would say. I think that here's how I view things. Ultimately, these people who we have some contempt for or think that we're a smarter version of, you know, there might be some narcissism of small differences going on here.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I'm guilty of that for sure.
Yeah. But go ahead. Yeah, we're like, well, I'm not a shit lib.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like,
exactly.
You know, so I think there's that. I think that we have to believe, you know, these people are more likely to ally with us than our enemies, obviously. And we have to pay attention to what they think and say. And some of it's not as stupid as we think it is. Like, not everything that comes out of their mouth. I mean, sometimes also, like, I think the other thing about normie liberalism is that it's kind of populist. Like, that's the actually existing liberalism of the United States. Like, if you wanted to be a populist, like, that's not elitist. Like, that's what liberals who are just like everyday run-of-the-mill liberals think and believe about things. Like, those are what liberals are. Those people are not like, they're the rank and file. Like, they're not like, and it's ridiculous to be like liberal elites about them like Republicans do. It's like, no, those people aren't elite, dude. They're just normal people who happen to be liberals. That whole idea the left has very hard time understanding and right wingers have very hard time understanding, which I think is like the most unappreciated thing in American politics because of kind of jujitsu that the Republicans did, where they convinced everybody that like liberals are weirdos. It's just like a lot of normal Americans just happen to actually be liberals. It's not like some fucking psyop. They're just, you know, like they're liberals.
Right.
And
it's
so
not
I think,
all to like disguise a certain class war that they're like oppressing amount of people are. Some of it, the effects of it might be.
Yes.
But
so
like,
is conservatism.
Right.
I think,
right.
I think it's just, you know, like the existence of liberalism in America has to be understood as something that needs to be worked within and not been. I think the left, I mean, this is what conservatives think we're doing and we should actually do. If you're like a committed leftist, you should try to take over the liberals from within and infiltrate them, not beat them over the head and be like, you stupid, like, and you suck and we're different from you. Just be like, yeah, we get along with this. Don't you think it would be better if we had healthcare though? And don't you think, you know, we should be nicer about this and maybe not build as many warplanes? And, you know, like, I think it has to be admitted that these people are people we need to work with.
Well, I think for a while it made sense because Bernie existed and the Bernie movement existed, right? Like there was
a protest
lot of talk
movement
of
too,
healthcare and stuff like that. But there was a sense that perhaps there was political possibility, and now that that's gone, it does feel a little bit more nihilistic and about self-labeling. But I don't know. Yeah. Like, I always think about that in terms of the healthcare stuff, where that was the most broadly accessible point that the left could offer up, that and like, you know, $15 minimum wage, right? Like, these are things that were broadly popular that people could understand and that appealed to the liberals as well.
Right.
And now it's harder because it's, you know, it's hard for the left to own the anti-war angle at this point, right?
I think.
And it's hard for the left to own a type of economic populism because the terms can't really be defined right now, because Biden is doing a lot with labor, you know, for example.
Right. And we're also in power. It's hard to run. It's hard to run as the populist angry at the corporations when you're the party in power. Like, it's very difficult to run as a populist in power. You know, like, you can do it as an outsider. You'll be like, yeah, look at these motherfuckers. But like, you know, when you're presiding over an economy that you want to brag about, you can't just be like, and another thing, nothing is working for you people. We've been in charge for the last 4 years.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
Like, so it's tricky. I think like Biden's in a remarkably healthy spot considering how tricky the political terrain is with everything that's going on in foreign policy and domestic policy. It's like, and I think that actually speaks to the weakness of Trump and the fact that people like find it pretty. I think if Trump was more normal Republican, not I don't think like his fascism necessarily does him any credit all the time. Like it shores up a core that he needs, but like it makes it unattractive and scary to people.
No, people hate him. I mean, yeah. I was very worried about this election. I'm no longer worried about it.
Just I go back and forth. People like, really do think he's disgusting. Like, yeah, and they hate they think him. Yeah.
And they also will still vote. I think that they just
a lot of people just wish he would die.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, yeah. I think that there's just like a I think where I've landed on this, John, is like following it is, you know, and talking to you about it over the years at this point. For those I actually no one would know, but you know, John and I started talking because just talk about poker a lot, but you know, obviously yeah. things bleed out. I was just like, I don't know. It's like, can we just do this? Can we do one more like vote blue no matter who? And then
we could go back to fighting.
Yeah. Cause like, this yeah. is the consequences of Trump winning at this point is like, it's bad. Right. And it's like, I find it odd how people they downgrade the stuff the political consequences of and think of him as being like super weak, but I don't know, man. He put
they're going to be a more organized
Supreme Court.
I know, dude. How can you possibly think that?
Fucking Roe v. Wade. Like,
he was, and it's not lost on these people that he was the only person able to finally fucking do that.
Right.
They're like,
right.
Here's the guy, the scary guy.
Right. You right. know? That's what I mean. It's like, yeah. Well, that was for both of our political formation years and like youth, that was like the America, all visions of like a liberal America are fucked and we're in a theocracy if that happens, right?
Yeah.
And it seemed impossible to happen, and then it happened, and people were just like, well, that's like, oh well, you know, like he didn't actually do anything. It's like like what did he have to actually do? Like, do you need people like rounded up into camps? Like, is that the only outcome?
Where does it get?
And they're like,
all right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. I agree with you. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Time to be alarmed.
Thank you for listening to the show, John. Thank you for coming on.
Of course. My
especially
absolute
on
pleasure.
Short notice.
Yeah.
If you'd like to email us, it's timetosaygoodbyepod@gmail.com. If you'd like to subscribe to the show, it's goodbye.substack.com. John, your book is coming out June 14th, June 18th.
18th, yes.
Yep, and it is called When the Clock Broke. We'll put a link to it in the show notes, and we'll also put a link to your great Substack, Unpopular Front. Although I bet most of our listeners, and maybe not everyone, but people are aware of your work.
Can't hurt to add a few more.
All right, talk to you soon.